Welcome back to Innovation Hub. I'm Kara Miller, and we're talking about the newest science surrounding global warming. And we're joined again by Bill McKibben, whose article in Rolling Stone, Global Warming's Terrifying New Math, has gone viral. We're also joined by Dan Trag, professor of geology at Harvard and the director of their Center for the Environment. And we were talking before the break about the way in which politics has become such an integral part of the global warming discussion. A few months ago, Richard Lester, who's the head of the Department of Nuclear Science and Engineering at MIT, told me that this is a really serious problem for scientists.
The whole subject of climate change has become deeply unfashionable in Washington. People don't talk about it. The president, who, when he came into office, talked about it a lot, has basically stopped talking about it. And we have, you know, quite large numbers of elected officials who are prepared to deny that there even is a phenomenon such as climate change. So the fact that it has become almost something that one doesn't talk about in Washington has greatly reduced one of the biggest reasons to initiate the kind of innovations that we will need in our electric power system.
So, Dan Trag, how did we get here?
Well, I think probably the most important explanation is just the recession. You know, when people are hurting, they don't want to hear about additional problems that'll cost them money. But, you know, there's some good news that comes out of this in the energy front that I think are, you know, a couple of things to note that are really important. One is that, you know, the price of solar panels, which used to be incredibly expensive, something like $8 or $10 a watt, people dreamed of the day when it might get below $1 a watt. We've actually gotten there now, mostly because of very cheap manufacturing in China. But the truth is that now new solar panels cost something like below $1 a watt, or at least around $1 a watt.
But do you see people plastering their roofs with solar panels?
Not yet, and that's because they're still more expensive than burning coal and turning it into electricity. We don't pay for other externalities with coal either, like conventional air pollution, which is very, very important. Another important thing is that, you know, windmills in Iowa, during the recession, while nobody was noticing, Iowa now is the same as Denmark. It has more than 20% wind generation. That's incredible. That happened overnight. And now farmers are just putting up windmills because they see their neighbors making money. And it's so much wind that actually Iowa is kind of a test bed for figuring out how to deal with the intermittency of wind. It's a wonderfully important problem, and hopefully Iowa will figure it out for the rest of us. But that's a very optimistic sign. We are moving towards a solution. We are getting closer to having renewables costing closer to what fossil fuels cost. Of course, the problem is that fossil fuels keep getting cheaper. We keep finding better, more efficient ways of getting fossil fuels out of the ground. And that means that, you know, it's a moving target for the renewables industry.
Which may lead to the issue of a carbon tax. But let's stay on this point for a moment, that it's hard to get, at least in the media, people beyond, on one hand, climate change, on the other, not. I'm going to play a clip for you. First, you'll hear E.J. Dionne on ABC's This Week. This is just last month. And he's talking about the really hot and, as you were saying, record-breaking summer that we're having right now.
During heat waves, belief in global warming goes up, surprise, surprise, in the polls. But what we've really seen is wild weather, not only here, but all over the world. And what I don't understand is why people are so resistant, why my conservative friends are so resistant in taking out an insurance policy. There is a lot of evidence that human activity is changing the climate. There's not a lot of dispute among scientists about this. Why wouldn't we want to take out an insurance policy to protect ourselves? Because if we go wrong on this, we're making an awfully big mistake.
And then Bill McKibben, commentator George Will, came in. He doesn't believe in global warming. And he responds to what E.J. Dionne said.
How do we explain the heat? One word, summer. What is so unusual about this? Now, come the winter, there will be a cold snap and lots of snow, and the same guys like EJ will start lecturing us there's a difference between the weather and the climate. I agree with that. We're having some hot weather. Get over it.
Bill McKibben, what do you say when somebody says, listen, this is weather. Get over it. And that's also where we are very much in the media, it feels like, on the one hand, on the other hand.
Look, the media has not covered itself with glory in covering climate change. And that, you know, spout off stuff that is, at this point, scientific nonsense is sad. I got to say, it's not making much difference anymore. People don't need the media anymore to tell them what's going on. They can look around them and see. You know, this world is changing at a remarkably rapid clip. People who follow the price of grain, people who follow the weather, people who live near the ocean and know that it's 30% more acid than it was 3 years ago. Everybody is starting to figure it out. I'm afraid in this case, you know, the pundit class is going to be a lagging indicator, not a leading one. But the day will come when we build a movement, and I think it's not that far away, strong enough to really take on the fossil fuel industry. And then all these guys who basically just wait for their instructions from, you know, GOP headquarters, which is pretty much fossil fuel funded, they'll, you know, change their tune in whatever direction the wind is blowing. The only trouble is the wind's going to be blowing harder because it's going to be hotter out.
Let me push back on that a little bit.
Sure.
Not that long ago, I talked to Minor Sinclair, who works at Oxfam America, and he has been down helping a lot with people who are trying to recover from Hurricane Katrina in the Gulf Coast. And I actually spoke with him about how city and state governments were dealing with those problems. Let's take a listen to that clip.
Well, in our work in the South, and again, the South, I think, comes from a more conservative basis, people's heads are in the sand around the larger issue around climate change. But when you're dealing with storms, with erosion of the coast, with the lack of water and drought and the increasing energy prices, at the city level, the state level, people are engaging in that way more directly.
But do they attribute it to climate change, or do they view it as an isolated incident? And when an isolated incident occurs, you deal with that, you know, one by one.
I don't really know, Kara. It could either be is that they don't see it as a pattern, or frankly, in their constituency, to talk about climate change and those kind of words is just too controversial, and so they'd rather deal with the ramifications of it.
So let me go back to you, Bill McKibben. Do you still see this kind of resistance and hand-wringing happening today?
The polling evidence is showing that a much higher percentage of Americans is now worried about climate change. And it's no wonder. I mean, 80% of American counties were in some kind of declared disaster area last year. There were more billion-dollar disasters than any year in American history. This year, as Dan points out, we've already had summer in March. We've had some of the most epic heat waves the planet's ever seen. We're locked in a wicked drought that's clearly going to raise the price of food. And, you know, more than half the nation's counties, as of this morning, are in declared disaster areas. Look, it's possible that we'll just figure out some way to ignore it all and go back to watching the Kardashians or whatever. But I think it's pretty clear that something is starting to change. People really are understanding that we better take some action. It hasn't yet become an issue in the presidential election. We'll see if it does. But we're right on the edge of that kind of thing.
Dan Tregg, yeah, what do you see happening when you look forward?
Well, a couple of things that are worth noting. One is that, you know, in terms of government taking it seriously, there are parts of government that take it very seriously. The military is actually thinking about climate change in a serious way. They're also thinking about energy conservation and transitions in energy in a serious way because they felt that they have led the country in the past and they understand their role in leading the country in the future. So that's something to watch. You know, the George Will's statements aside, the fact is the Pentagon takes climate change very seriously because they think it's important and they think an insurance policy is a very useful thing.
And in spite of that, though, we see that the government overall is looking to diversify fuel sources. In fact, President Obama has supported fracking, for example, and continued drilling.
Given our energy needs, in order to sustain economic growth and produce jobs and keep our businesses competitive, we are going to need to harness traditional sources of fuel, even as we ramp up production of new sources of renewable homegrown energy. So today we're announcing the expansion of offshore oil and gas exploration, but in ways that balance the need to harness domestic energy resources and the need to protect America's natural resources. under the leadership of Secretary Salazar, will employ new technologies that reduce the impact of oil exploration. We'll protect areas that are vital to tourism, the environment, and our national security. And we'll be guided not by political ideology, but by scientific evidence.
So, Dan Trag, do we really see consistency coming from this administration when it comes to fuel sources?
It's a very complicated thing. The truth is that although changes in our energy system are essential, we are so dependent on oil and gas that we're not going to get rid of them in the next 2 years. The systems we build are incredibly expensive. Even a single power plant can cost several billion dollars. And so this transition is going to take decades. That's frustrating as we watch the climate change, but it's also true that it's unlikely that people are going to be willing to spend so much money to basically just get rid of all of the old infrastructure, throw their cars away, and buy electric cars. The transition is going to happen, hopefully, but it'll happen slowly. And in that context, as a president, it's difficult. You have to do a variety of things that are important, both with the current energy system and the future one.
What do you see happening? Bill McKibben points out in Rolling Stone that you add together the U.S. and China, and right there, two countries out of all the countries in the world, right there, you're at 40% of emissions. China has now overtaken the U.S. It was the U.S. for a long, long time, the leader in emissions. But China is obviously growing fast. A lot of people are entering the middle class, and they've now overtaken us.
You know, I was in China last year on a special delegation to talk with our counterparts about climate. The Chinese are actually much more worried about climate change than we are. They're very aware that in the past, Chinese governments have been overthrown by peasant revolutions. They're very worried about food production and drought in China and water supply. And they're very smart about technology. They've been building more efficient plants, and they're doing a lot. Are they doing enough? No. But they're doing a lot compared to what we're doing. I think the truth is that it's true that two countries represent 40% or so of the world's emissions. That's both good news and bad news. The good news is that, in fact, you don't need to have 200 countries in the room to figure out how to solve this problem. If China and the U.S. actually agreed to get serious and they really wanted to solve this problem, the rest of the world would follow. And that's the good part of this. If this were really, if you really needed to get 100 countries to solve this problem, it would be a much more difficult one. You need to get two big ones and a bunch of other medium-sized ones.
But it's hard to convince those two countries.
It is hard to convince these two countries. It's hard to convince this country. But I think we were almost there in the last presidential election when both presidential candidates, McCain and Obama, agreed that this was a serious problem. McCain has since reversed himself with pressure from the right. When Larry Summers was president of Harvard, you know, former Treasury Secretary, Larry said to me, you know, action on climate change in Washington is going to take a very long time, a lot longer than people think. But when it comes, it's going to come very quickly. And our job is to be prepared so that we know what to do when the political will is there. And I think there's a lot of wisdom there. I think, you know, with Bill McKibben continuing the pressure through activism and with a variety of other activities going on politically, I think it's very important to be ready because we don't know when things could flip. The truth is that most of the public does believe in climate change. Most of the public is concerned about climate change. They're just more concerned about healthcare. They're more concerned about their jobs. And that's understandable. But at some point that this may jump to the top of the agenda once again.
Bill McKibben, let's talk about that activism. And I think what's really the interesting component of what you want to do is sort of start a campaign that resembles the campaign against apartheid in the 1980s. Talk about what that campaign would look like.
Well, look, of course, the people who really fought that campaign hardest were the people in South Africa who liberated themselves. But when he got out of jail, Nelson Mandela came to California, and the first place he went was the University of California, where students had forced the divestiture of $3 billion in stock tainted by its ties to that racist regime. And he said, "We could not have done this without you." We're going to try and employ some of that same logic. It does not make sense for universities to be funding the education of their students with investments in companies whose business plans rule out the possibility of a workable planet on which to enact that education. It does not make sense for pension funds to be putting their people's retirement money in companies whose business plan dictates they won't have a workable planet to retire on. Look, it's pretty clear by now that the only thing these guys care about is money. Rex Tillerson, the CEO of Exxon, said last 2 weeks ago, said, you know what, my predecessors were not telling you the truth. In fact, global warming is real. But it's an engineering problem with engineering solutions. And asked for an example, he said, well, if we need to move our crop production areas, we will. That's crazy talk. Our crop production areas are what other people call farms, and there's actually no place to move them to. You can't uproot Iowa because it's gotten too hot to grow things there and put it on the Arctic tundra because there's no topsoil. What we need to do is not have every farmer in the world adapt. What we need to do is have Exxon adapt its business plan, and Chevron and ConocoPhillips and Peabody Coal and everybody else. They've got to keep 80% of the reserves they've got now underground because we clearly can't burn any more of that. That's the burden of the math in this piece that I just wrote. We've got to keep most of that underground, and that's what the fight's about. These guys are willing, in fact, eager to alter the atmosphere of the climate if they can make a few more years of record profits. It's the most radical thing that humans have ever engaged in.
And do you see students being either willing or able to get, you know, Yale and Harvard, you know, like you said, the University of California system to say, forget ExxonMobil. It may seem like it has a good, you know, price-earnings ratio, but we are not interested.
We'll find out. You know, people never believe that anyone can change anything until they do. This time last year, everybody told us we were nuts to try taking on this Keystone pipeline down out of the tar sands of Canada. But we said, look, it's the second biggest pool of carbon on the planet. We've got to try. We ended up having the largest civil disobedience action in 30 years in this country, 1,253 people arrested at the White House, and a few weeks later, ringed the White House with tens of thousands of people. And a few days after that, the Obama administration said, okay, we'll take another look at it. Now, I don't know whether we're going to win more than a temporary victory there. The fossil fuel industry is fighting back hard. But we've demonstrated that we can begin to stand up to these guys. We're going to have to stand up to them a lot more. I don't know whether look, if you're asking me for prediction about whether we're going to win this whole fight or not, I got to tell you the science is kind of dark right now. The only thing that can change the equation is the mustering of a lot of political will in a very short period of time. That's what movements are about. That's what we're going to try. If you want to help, come by 350.org.
Dan Tragg, can you imagine the divestiture of fossil fuel companies coming to Harvard Yard?
I actually can imagine that. I actually think if
you can,
if you actually,
okay.
Absolutely. I think if there is. A topic ripe for student activism, this is certainly one of them, and I think Bill's caught on to something important here. A complication is that, unlike apartheid, which could end so abruptly, the timescale of change in this one makes it very difficult. It's hard to say, what is it exactly that you're fighting for? You know, fighting for some legislation that is cap and trade, that's not very satisfying. So it's a little bit of difficult that way. You know, a sobering perspective is one that my colleague Andy Hoffman at the University of Michigan has talked about. He compares thinking about climate change today in the U.S. to thinking about slavery in the 18th century in London, where if you said to somebody, I want to get rid of slaves, get rid of slavery, they would have said, you're crazy. Our whole economy depends on slavery. What are you talking about? And that's what it feels like talking about getting rid of fossil fuels today. It took a long time to get rid of slavery. And
that's, you know, Dan's exactly right. And the only problem is that in this case, unlike slavery or something else, the time isn't being set in by human, according to human dictates. It would be very nice to have a long time. And I have no doubt that given a century, we could get off fossil fuel easily. easily, gradually, comfortably, and onto something else. The problem, as he knows, of course, is better than anyone, is that physics and chemistry are forcing the pace. And given the science of this past year, I mean, it looks like the window in which we have to operate is narrower, and hence the actions we need bolder all the time.
There's one other component of this that I think is important to put out there, which is the timescale of climate change. Most people don't think about this. You know, we're so focused on human timescales, what's going to happen in the next 20 years, 50 years, or maybe 100 years. But here's the important thing, that a lot, maybe 20 or 30% of the CO2 we put in the air is going to be there tens of thousands of years from now. So the decisions we make in the next few generations are going to be affecting the Earth for tens of thousands of years. That's, for me, we don't even know how to think about that.
Yeah, it's hard for people to think that long term, I think,
and,
kind of scale.
I'm a geologist, so I do think about those timescales, but the truth is, that's really troubling. And it turns out there's a lot of clarity that comes from those timescales. Over those timescales, it's not a question of how fast Greenland's going to melt. Greenland is gone. You know, sea level, it's not a question of exactly how much. It's going to be tens of meters of sea level rise over those timescales. We are committing future generations to a pace of climate change that we wouldn't tolerate for ourselves. Mm-hmm. And we are really enforcing this on the future, not just of our grandchildren, but of our children's children's children for thousands of generations.
Not to mention every other species on the planet.
That's right.
And before, very, very, very good point.
Before we wrap up, I want to check in with WGBH science reporter Heather Goldstone, who has done a lot of reporting on the effects of climate change in this local area. Heather, where are you seeing the particular effects of global warming in Massachusetts?
I'll be honest with you, and I think you've already heard this from your other two guests, that when you really start to look around and become aware of the science, it's hard not to see global warming having an impact almost everywhere. But I'll just mention a couple here in southeastern Massachusetts. Migratory birds are showing up, many of them showing up to 9 days earlier. So all it takes is maybe a pair of binoculars and looking out at your back bird feeder to start seeing the impacts of global warming there. Things like purple finches and turkey vultures didn't used to winter on Cape Cod and are now seen fairly commonly. That may not sound that bad. It's just a change in which birds are around, and that's fine. We're also seeing a lot of changes in ocean life. And given our dependence on fisheries here in Massachusetts, that could start to have some major economic impacts. The lobster populations south and west of Cape Cod, so Buzzards Bay, Narragansett Bay, Long Island Sound, that whole area, populations in the past 10 years have really just collapsed. And the major culprit appears to be rising water temperatures. Water temperatures during the summer have just hit a threshold that the lobsters can no longer tolerate. And it looks like that could cause essentially the collapse of that historic fishery. We're also seeing over half of all other commercially exploited fish species moving to try to stay in their comfort zones. We could, by 2050, even see a Georgia's Bank that is too warm for cod. Believe it or not, you know, Cape Cod named after cod, and we may have waters that are too warm for cod within the next few decades. So I think there are a lot of impacts, you know, that can be seen. It just requires opening one's eyes and paying attention to a little bit of the science that's out there.
And do people in the industries, let's say in the fisheries industry or even in the tourism industry, if we're talking about, you know, the change in beaches and the change in water, do people connect this to global warming or do they think of it sort of separately and economically?
That's a really good question, and I think it really depends on the industry, and at this point just depends from person to person. Out in the Pacific Northwest, oyster growers are very, very concerned about the increase in ocean acidity, which I believe you mentioned earlier. As carbon dioxide is absorbed by the ocean, it actually increases the acidity of the ocean. The ocean is now 30% more acidic than it was 200 years ago, and that makes it really hard for oysters and other shellfish to actually build their shells. And out in the Pacific Northwest, they've had failing oyster populations that they've really had to start figuring out how to re-engineer their hatcheries and get their oyster growers back on track. We haven't seen that same degree of impact here, and so oyster farmers on the Cape and in Massachusetts are kind of, this seems to be something that's just hitting their horizon. A lot of fishermen are still saying, oh, well, we think we're seeing more impacts from overfishing than we are from global warming at this point. But I think it is something that's starting to enter people's minds. And as you said, especially with things like rising sea level and how that's going to exacerbate erosion issues that we already have, certainly that is starting to weigh on the minds of planners and business people around the Cape and other coastal areas.
That's really interesting. We see the impacts globally and we see them locally. We've been talking with WGBH's science reporter Heather Goldstone about global warming, and we were joined earlier this hour by Bill McKibben, author of the recent Rolling Stone article, Global Warming's Terrifying New Math, and by Dan Schrag, geologist and director for the Center for the Environment at Harvard. Thanks so much for having this important discussion with us this hour. If you want to share this conversation, you can get our free podcast from iTunes or link to it from our website, wgbh.org/innovationhub, where you can read more about our guest today and hear previous shows. Next week on Innovation Hub, the conversation is about ethical behavior in the workplace.
In lab settings, but also in the field, we see that a lot of people cheat by a little bit, and they go on with their lives thinking that they're actually competent and interesting and good people.
You might be surprised how much workplace culture shapes our behavior and the effect that ripples throughout companies that has led to the kind of problems we've seen with corporations from Enron to Lehman Brothers to Barclays.
We see it, and we don't take it as our responsibility to act on that bad behavior. And from my perspective, we become a culprit in this story when we see egregious behavior and do nothing about it.
I'm Kara Miller, and I hope you'll join us next week for that discussion on Innovation Hub. Consultations, they're quite aware of what they're going through. Changes, turn and face the strange. Changes, don't tell them to grow up out of it.